So if you're expected to release a new watch twice a year, you have to constantly reinvent the wheel, and reinventing the wheel often leads to unnecessary detailing, and it leads you to making choices that aren't necessarily driven by need, but rather by perceived want, or just as a way to differentiate the new watch from what came before it.
Hey everybody, I'm your host Stephen Pulverant, and this is Hodinkee Radio. This week I'm joined by our new Hodinkee design columnist, Liz Stinson. Liz has an amazing history writing about design from a variety of perspectives for a variety of publications. She currently serves as the editor-in-chief of the AIGA's website, Ion Design. And Liz has written a handful of stories for the website, and we get into those and some of the details of those. But we also talk more broadly about what design is, what design's role in watches and watchmaking, and what maybe you don't think about that impacts the watches that are on your wrist. We also talk about some things that the watch world could learn by looking outside, and some things that Liz learned as a design expert coming to the watch world for the first time. So, if you love design, if you love watches, this is a perfect episode for you. Also, just one thing to note, Liz actually just ran a column about some watches made of recycled gunmetal that you should for sure check out, but we recorded this episode before that ran, so you won't hear about it in the conversation. There is a link to it down in the show notes. So without further ado, let's do this. Hey Liz, how are you?
I'm great.
It's good to finally chat with you. You've been writing for the site now for a couple months, and this is the first time you and I are like actually meeting, I mean, sort of face-to-face on Zoom, I guess.
Yeah. Yes, some semblance of face-to-face, I guess.
Yeah. It's, you know, it's nice though, because you're in New York, I'm in California, and we can still do this. So we'll just jump right into things. I mean, you've become our design columnist over the last few months, and that's something that I was really excited about when Nick said he was going to bring in somebody to really focus on design and the world of design and how it relates to watches, not just like, hey, this is a beautifully designed watch, which I was really excited to see. And I thought maybe we could start off with a really kind of like big question, which is, what is design? I think a lot of people, when they hear that word, think it's about like aesthetics and making things pretty and, you know, expensive chairs that you buy at Design Within Reach. But like, what do you think design means to you as a reporter and a writer?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely all of those things, but it's a lot more as well.
Sure.
Design can and does mean something different to everybody. Even for me, design can refer to various things depending on the context. I think that's what makes it such an interesting focus as a writer. You get to play with the conception and misconception of the term because, yes, design can speak to the aesthetics of something, but it can also speak to the function of something. And for me, it really comes down to understanding why things work the way they work. At its most basic, I think design is all about intention. It's a series of decisions that are made about how something should look or feel or work. And that conceit is actually a really strong foundation for storytelling, I found.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting point, right? Is that like, because of how multidisciplinary it is and how like foundational it is, it's such a fruitful place for a writer. Like I've also, you know, we were chatting before we turned the mics on here. Like I've worked at a design magazine. I'm a big like design enthusiast. And as a storyteller, it's so exciting when you have all of those possibilities and all of those layers. And I wonder how you think about design as a platform for you for telling stories and telling stories maybe that kind of like matter with a capital M, if that makes sense.
Yeah, design for me is a really interesting place for storytelling because, like I mentioned, it's really about how things work. And the reality is that we're all interacting with some form of design on a daily basis, whether that is the interface on your phone or the chair you're sitting in or the building where you live. And I think being able to articulate and understand how those things are made and why they're made and the impact that those objects have on your life is incredibly important. For me, design writing is sort of, it's not really where I imagined my career to go, but I think that curious person, it's a really fruitful place to land simply because it merges the worlds of aesthetics with more of the functional side of things. And being able to dive into that and ask people questions and have them explain how something came to be is really exciting. And when it comes to deciding what's a story worth telling, I think that's a question that every journalist asks themselves, design writing, politics, otherwise.
Sure, yeah.
And for me, at least, it comes down to, has this story been told before? Is there something here that will surprise people? Are there constraints that need to be talked about? Potentially with design writing, you're just talking about why something looks the way it looks, which is also a very interesting thing to do. I love trend reporting. I think that's a really fun piece of what we do when we're talking about design writing in terms of graphic design is figuring out like how does what you're seeing in the world connect back to the waves of culture, if you want to phrase it that way.
Yeah. No, I think that's really fascinating. And I completely agree with you. And, you know, you mentioned that you didn't set out to be a design writer, which I think is really fascinating. I think, you know, in the world of design, in fashion, in technology, in watches, in lots of these more like niche subject areas or like enthusiast subject areas, people are first like passionate about the thing and then decide like, oh, maybe if I'm passionate about this thing, like being a journalist and covering this might be a fun, you know, career. But you kind of went the other way, right? Like you went to journalism school, you're a journalist through and through, and then sort of found design later. I wonder how you ended up on that beat and why you thought that might be like a fruitful place for you to like dig in and spend time.
I don't think I knew what design was when I was in college. I was always generally interested in, I'm doing air quotes here, but visual culture. But the concept of design was not really on my radar. I mean, I grew up in Nebraska, not that that means anything, but it just was, I was not in a place where thinking about design, talking about design was really top of mind. Like, had I known what design was back then, maybe that's a direction I would have gone in.
Sure.
But when I was in journalism school, I figured I'd get out and I'd go work at a newspaper like I had done for all of my internships. But when I left school, I ended up moving to LA and I took an internship at Variety and then at Wired. And mind you, this was 2009 when there were no jobs on the market.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And people tend to gravitate towards the things that they are interested in, but it's also a little bit of happenstance. So the way that I ended up writing about design, to come back to your original question, is I had been working at Condé Nast as the executive assistant to a man named Tom Wallace. He was the editorial director. And during that period, I was still doing some freelance work from Wired after having been an intern there. And I met my then editor, Cliff Kwong, who had started a vertical at Fast Company called Co-Design. And I think it was really the first of its kind in terms of the way a publication approached and talked about design as a thing that mattered. And that was really interesting to me because I didn't realize that was an option to talk about this almost intangible idea that you could talk about both beauty and form and art, but also talk about the way things were made and get into the engineering and the science behind it. It was just this beautiful Venn diagram of all of the things that I was interested in. And I met Cliff. We got along really well. I started writing for him, and I guess the rest is history.
Yeah, that story is not totally unfamiliar. I think a lot of people, like I said, who end up in these kinds of journalism jobs come through interesting pathways, and that's one I've definitely heard before, and one that isn't totally dissimilar from my own. You know, like I did not set out in college to be a watch journalist, you know, but
right.
I ended up and, you know, a little over a decade later, here I am. Yeah, I mean, that last bit there, I think about why you find design so compelling kind of is a perfect encapsulation of why I think watches are kind of a perfect topic for you to cover. They do encapsulate all of those various areas of interest and different perspectives. and in such a sort of like small footprint, detail-oriented object, and one with like tons of history, but also that's deeply rooted in ideas about technology and progress. And like, there's all of these things wrapped up in them. And I wonder, like, were watches something like at all on your radar before Nick kind of called you and was like, hey, you want to write about watches for Hodinkee?
The short answer is sort of. I love watches. I love the look of them. I love the function of them. I like to wear them, although I don't really do so very often. It's a very useful piece of jewelry, which I am into as a concept. And funnily enough, when I was at Wired, I actually went to Baselworld in 2015.
Okay.
I went with the advertising team. They wanted a writer to go, and they thought having a design perspective would bring an interesting lens to watch writing. And so I was there, and it was absolutely wild. I had no idea at the time what the watch world was like. And so to go to Switzerland and be introduced to watches that cost hundreds of thousands of dollars was really mind-blowing to me. Yeah. And it was mind-blowing to me from both just like the sheer magnitude of the watch industry, but also the attention to detail that people put into their watches. And so I think that was really a good foundation for me to appreciate watches in a way that I might not otherwise.
Yeah, I mean, you can't really get a better kind of like trial by fire than Baselworld from those days. I mean, that was the time when everybody was still there. I mean, it was really the bulk of the industry. And, you know, if you're somebody passionate about watches, you were in Basel, Switzerland that week. And it's, like you said, your eyes really open to like the levels at which people can be interested in this. And I wonder, you know, obviously that was your introduction. And now that you're, you know, writing this column for us, I wonder, just in the last few months, are there any like new layers you've discovered to the watch world, or anything that the watch world's maybe like taught you about your own sensibilities just since you've been digging into it now?
Yeah, I think that first and foremost, I've been really pleasantly surprised and frankly sort of amazed by the community that reads Hodinkee. People who read about design really care about design, but people who read about watches really, really care about watches. And that to me is really cool. But beyond that, I've been impressed by just how much people know about watches. It's such an insular industry that has its own history, and being able to have one foot in there as I am learning about watches is really valuable. I'm not a watch expert, obviously, and I'm hoping that brings a different perspective to Hodinkee. Obviously, like the people who work at the publication, as Nick says, you know, have watch knowledge in spades. And so that's something that I'm learning as I write each piece, you know, talking to people like yourself or Jack, who has lots of knowledge and is very willing to sit down with me and say, actually, have you thought about it this way? That having access to that kind of institutional knowledge is really valuable. In terms of my own sensibilities, I don't know that it has really changed so much, except for I can say that the more I know about a subject, the more I can appreciate it, even if it doesn't speak to my own particular tastes.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I love this idea that you have expertise, but you also have a bit of like amateurism here in just the watches themselves. And I think that probably makes for some interesting like tensions in your writing process, right? Like you're totally an expert and have like an amazing handle on this one thing, and then the other part of it is like all new and fresh. And I wonder if you think that pushes you creatively, or like ends up putting you in a spot where you can do work that you like wouldn't be able to do otherwise.
Well, I do think having an outsider perspective on a subject matter leads you to asking questions that people who are more intimately connected to that world might not ask. So from that perspective, yeah, I do think that being an amateur in some ways is really valuable. The flip side of that is, of course, your community, who knows absolutely everything about watches. And it's terrifying that I might miss a affect or not be able to nod to this piece of history or legacy that is considered really important in institutional knowledge. But, you know, for me, writing is really about answering questions about the things that I find curious or interesting.
Right.
And so the watch world really lends itself to that for me, frankly, because I don't know a lot about watches from both a technical perspective and a historical perspective. I'm sure that's a horrible thing to say on Hodinkee Radio, but it's the truth.
No, I don't think it's a terrible thing to say at all. And I think, you know, one of the complaints that I think I have and some of my colleagues have with the watch world in particular is it can be so insular. It can be so inward looking. It's, you know, for the most part, it's a one country industry. It's, you know, lots of people who are in this business, their families have been in this business for generations. And that sometimes breeds complacency. It breeds navel gazing. And I think having new ideas and new perspectives is crucial, both in the industry and in terms of like criticism and coverage of the industry. So I want to make sure we get to dig into some of your columns. I mean, not that we're going to do a like, you know, read along here, but I had some questions from reading your columns that while I've got you on the line and the microphones are turned on, I thought we could dig into. Does that work for you, Liz?
Let's do it.
Awesome. Well, let's start with your first column, which is about something that, you know, myself and Ian, one of our designers on the team, shout out to Ian, have spent way too much time talking about in the office in the pre-COVID days, which is typography and watches, and specifically the sort of like woeful way that typography is typically deployed. Our mutual friend, Jonathan Heffler, the typographer, the guy who designed Decimal, the typeface kind of inspired by watches, you know, sort of in your column said, the choices that have been made are so anarchic. And you then find things like a $65,000 watch with the same typeface used for a jet ski or a sports drink, which, I mean, besides the fact that Jonathan is super sharp and that wit there is amazing, is totally true. And it's crazy when you think about the attention to detail put into these products to then just like go buy an off-the-shelf typeface. Or even I've seen many Swiss-made watches that use Ariel instead of Helvetica, I'm guessing because the license is much cheaper. And that kind of stuff just like kills me. And I wonder your thoughts kind of on a top level about that concept.
Yeah. So the reason I wanted to write about this is exactly the reason that you stated. It's perplexing that every other detail about a watch is really considered. And the typeface on the watch face is one of the more visible aspects of a watch face. And yet it doesn't really get the level of attention that it deserves. And I think that probably, and I don't want to speak for watch brands, but I assume that it's a matter of resources and perceived value. You know, why commission a custom typeface if you can just use an off-the-rack font that looks pretty much okay? I mean, I think for people who care about design, the differences between Ariel and Helvetica on a watch face are very obvious. But for the general consumer, maybe the watch brand is assuming nobody will notice. You know, I think the issue with that is that good typography really does set your brand apart. It's hugely visible. It should be considered with care. And I'm not really sure why watch brands don't think about this more often beyond the fact that I said it's probably a matter of money, time, and just maybe not thinking that it matters. I actually have a question for you, Stephen.
Yeah, sure.
Was this something that you noticed before this column, or did people in the watch world ever comment on the fact that the typography on a watch face was less than good, I guess?
Yeah, it definitely is. But I think amongst a very specific set of like nerds, you know, like I think like it's something that bothered me. It's something that, you know, my colleague Ian has, I know, spent a lot more time, and he actually like designs typefaces and like is really, he's much more in this than I am. And so I know he's paid a lot of attention. I mean, Jonathan and I have had some conversations about this. And then, you know, I have friends who are just design geeks. I have friends who are in the industry who have all had thoughts. And I think it's a thing that more gets noticed, I would say, when it's really good or really bad, and the stuff in the middle isn't what gets noticed. And I think it's really telling that you said that, like, one of the reasons they get away with it is that it's pretty much fine. And it's like, those are three, like, all three of those words are about, like, inherent compromise.
Yes.
And like mediocrity, you know, it's like, I guess it's okay, maybe. And it's like, you know, I don't think a lot of these watch brands would say that about like case shape or about the fineness of the machining of their bracelet links or about the precision of their movements. Like, but for some reason they think that like good enough is okay with, to your point, what is like maybe the visually most important element of the watch. And it's, you know, I think it's telling one, like, I mean, you cite Hermès in your story, and like Hermès commissioned Philippe Apolloic to design a typeface just for their watches. And it's like, that stands out. And there's a reason why the Slim to Hermès got so much attention and continues to get so much attention and so much love, because they went that extra mile. And the fact that most brands saying pretty much fine is good enough means that when a brand says, no, this is really important to us, they can really push it and really kind of get some acclaim for it.
Right. Well, it's striking to me that both examples in my piece, Hermès and Chanel, are fashion brands.
Right.
And so for better or for worse, they are potentially more attuned to the aesthetic nuances on a watch face in the way that another brand that might be known for its complications or its engineering prowess doesn't really need or doesn't think it needs to pay attention to.
Yeah, I think you're totally right. And I think it's crazy to me. I mean, I won't put this brand on blast by name. I don't think that would necessarily be fair. But like, you know, one of the brands I was referring to using Ariel, and the brand that Jonathan's referring to using this, specifically the sports drink typeface, I know exactly what he's referring to there. And this is not a small watch brand. Like these are big, major brands that are selling hundreds of thousands of watches a year, you know, their companies worth billions of dollars. Like, this is not small potatoes here. And I think it's funny that it's such a blind spot, because you would think they know better. But I think you're right that there's something maybe about these companies that are coming to watches from a different place that are used to paying attention to it. So I wonder if maybe there's an injection of some like new blood into the more traditional players of people who care about this, if it would change quickly, or if, you know, this is just something sort of entrenched in the industry in a way that like I have not pinpointed yet, and that I don't think any of us have quite figured out.
Yeah, you know, I'm not really sure what the answer is to that, but it's also interesting that it was really hard for me to find examples of watch brands who wholesale designed their own typeface. You know, there were a couple brands in the piece, for example, Nomos, that didn't have a custom typeface, but they did customize typefaces, if that makes sense.
Mm.
And I think a lot of watch brands take that approach where they say, you know, I really like this typeface, but to work on this watch, we're going to have to tweak it a little bit. And then they consider that a version of custom typography. There's nothing wrong with that. And I think that's much better than just slapping a typeface on a watch without doing anything to it at all, because obviously a watch has particular constraints and requirements to make something look good. But hopefully that's a nice middle ground where more watch brands can land if they don't want to invest in hiring a type designer to create them a custom typeface. I don't have any idea what it would cost for a type designer to create a custom typeface for a brand, but I imagine if you are selling a watch for $50,000, you can probably spring for it.
Yeah, I think that's the case. Knowing a handful of type designers, even ones living pretty nice lifestyles, I think these brands can probably afford it. But I mean, this actually segues us kind of nicely into something else I wanted to talk about, which is your column about why watch dials are so busy. And I'll admit, I've written probably five versions of this column over the last 10 years and have not been happy enough with a single one of them to publish it. but you really like hit close to home on this one. This is a thing that's driven me absolutely nuts as long as I've been in the watch world. And it, I think, relates to the type conversation in a way where it's like, there seems to be so much attention paid to engineering, to industrial design, to a sort of artistry with these watches, but not always to graphic design and to what's actually on the dials. And I wonder what you think about that. Like, how does that strike you from sort of a, you know, 50,000 foot view?
I think the complicated thing is that the engineering and graphic design of a watch are very intertwined. Mm. What you see on a watch face, as far as I can tell, is often a reflection of the engineering itself.
Yeah.
And I understand why watchmakers want to show that off. I don't really understand why there has to be so much on every single watch. I think that striking a balance between engineering know-how and the aesthetics is really a challenging thing to do because, you know, like I say in that column, oftentimes it feels like these watch dials or these watch faces are there. It's an engineering flex to show off what they can do. It's really hard to make a pared back watch design and still communicate to your customers that a lot of thought and consideration went into it. And so I'm not really sure what the answer is and how to do that. But I do think that there are the tiny details that make a difference. So that could be typography, right? Like if you're going to have a spare watch face, invest in the typography if there's going to be typography on it. And that can make all of the difference.
Yeah, I think that's you've hit the nail on the head there, right? Which is like if you're going to do less, make it less and better. And if you're going to do more, there needs to be some sort of clarity. And I think you're, you know, just knowing a lot of watchmakers and a lot of folks at these watch companies, there's sort of an impulse to like flex all the time, you know, and as hard as possible, and to feel like, well, we have to let, like, we're charging a lot of money for these things, so we have to make it obvious to the consumer why this thing is expensive and complicated and difficult and interesting. And sometimes, like, maybe pumping the brakes a little bit would actually result in a like more desirable product, even if that product is only sort of extolling 70% of its own virtues on the face of it.
Well, something that I learned in the process of reporting this story is how tied all of these features are to the marketing and release cycles of watches. Mm. And that to me explains a lot of this. So if you're expected to release a new watch, and I'm making this up, twice a year, you have to constantly reinvent the wheel. And reinventing the wheel often leads to unnecessary detailing, in my opinion. And it leads you to making choices that aren't necessarily driven by need, but rather by perceived want or just as a way to differentiate the new watch from what came before it.
Yeah, no, that makes a ton of sense. I think that's a really good insight. I wonder on a related note, like how much you think there's a sort of aesthetic of expensiveness in watches. I feel like there's a certain design language, and I can't put a like fine point on it, which makes me think I might be imagining it, but it feels like there's a sort of vague aesthetic of expensiveness, and not luxury, but of specifically expense, that kind of traces its way across watchmaking. Is that something you noticed? Am I kind of imagining this? I'm not entirely sure, to be honest.
When I first pitched this piece to my editor, Nick, I think I phrased it as, why are watches so complicated? And my initial theory was that exactly what you just said. People are paying a lot of money for these things, so therefore, there needs to be a lot to them. In terms of how that translates into an aesthetic of expensiveness, I think that it's difficult for me as someone who's not deep into the watch world to really articulate what that aesthetic is, but I know it when I see it. And the best way that I can describe it is excess, right? Like there are things on the watch that don't need to be there. And there's a difference between something looking expensive and looking luxurious, as you astutely pointed out. And those, you know, luxurious things are often expensive, but they don't speak the same language. I'm rambling a little bit because I'm grappling for what that looks like. What does expensive look like? And my knee-jerk reaction to that is it's ostentatious. It's too much. It is a unnecessary dedication to strange materials, to gemstones, to chronographs and date wheels all crammed onto the same watch dial. Sorry, this is not a good answer. I'm not sure, like you, I'm not sure how to talk about this.
No, it's a great answer. And I think the difficulty in speaking about it kind of speaks to, you know, where I'm at on this. So I say it's a brilliant answer mostly because it ends up agreeing with me, which is that like, there's something there, but it's not something precise. It's something a little bit ephemeral and something kind of idiosyncratic to watches. And I think that's something fascinating about watches is like, I, you know, having covered high-end technology, having covered clothing, having covered furniture, like I'm sure you feel the same way. Like watches are kind of a different beast. Like they have their own language and their own culture and their own vernacular. And it's curious and it's strange. And for me, it's one of the things that makes covering it so compelling, you know. After more than a decade of doing it, you know, nonstop, it doesn't get old because it is so strange and fascinating and kind of like imprecise in a way.
I just wonder how this became the visual culture of watchmaking. That's an overgeneralization, obviously. There are lots of watches that don't take a really busy or how you described it, expensive approach to their design. But what I would love to do is figure out where does this come from? I mean, what are the forces that are compelling watchmakers to do this? Is it the fact that a watch is an object like a chair where it sort of has built-in constraints, right?
Yeah.
Like there's only so much you can do with it. And so the way to distinguish your watch from a different watch is to come up with your own design language. And maybe that's what propels people to try to do more with less space.
Yeah.
I don't know. That's just one way of thinking about it. But I think it would be very interesting to be able to trace, like if someone were to do, I don't know, to like put together a timeline of watch design from the early days until today. Like, I wonder if what we would see through that, you know, like, I just wonder if there would be a lot of consistencies, but I just wonder if there would be a point during history where things sort of go off the rails.
Yeah, no, I think that's super interesting. And if anybody listening to this wants to write that book, please do. And you have pre-sold a copy to me. I would love to read whatever somebody would be willing to produce on that. You know, we could probably talk for the next like 2 hours about all of your columns here. I mean, we're up to, you know, five or six of them now. And they're all fantastic. We'll link to them in the show notes. But the last one I want to ask you about before we get into a little bit of a fun, like lightning round at the end is you wrote a column called How Motherhood Changed My Perception of Time. And the deck is changed is probably not the right word, more like obliterated. And I've got two main questions for you here. And the first one is, what made you think about writing this article? Like, what was the thing that pushed you to want to talk about this?
Yeah, so this actually started with Nick again, and he wrote to me asking if I wanted to write something about how motherhood has changed my perception of time, exactly what the column is about. And it's something that I had been giving a lot of thought to since my son was born. He's about to turn one. And like I mentioned in the piece, when you have a kid, for those of you out there who are listening to this and who have children, you know that time totally shifts. It totally shifts after having a baby. It both expands and contracts in different ways. And the truth is that I was really anxious about time when I first had Sasha because time didn't really exist in the way that I had previously understood it. You know, time itself didn't matter, which sounds like a total stoner thought, but it's true. I didn't need to look at the clock because the clock didn't matter. I was on an entirely different biologically driven schedule, and it really changed the way that I interacted with time. You know, I was really just living by, is it light? Is it dark? Does he need to eat? Is it time to change his diaper? That obviously changes a few months in when you start to get back on a schedule, but there's a lot to be said around how schedules are really the way that we think about time.
Yeah.
You know, having to be somewhere at a certain place, having a calendar that pings you and says, Liz, you have to talk to Stephen at 5 p.m. That structures everything. When there's no structure, things go off the rails a bit.
Yeah. No, I think that's really fascinating. And for me, the thing that I took out of this column that to me is really the heart of this column, right, is it's also about how we value time, right? It's about how time has meaning for us, no?
Yeah. I mean, that is part of this column. I think part of it is thinking about how did my perception of time change and why did that matter? And I think the takeaway, if I could go back in time, is I wish I could hold on to some of that ability or necessity to not be ruled by all of these external factors that dictate where I need to be and when I need to be there, and let that drive what I think of as time. I mean, when you have a child, like, you cram so much into every day that it's really hard to not feel regimented once they actually have their schedule. I mean, today, my life is sort of ruled around his nap. So like, I have these 2-hour increments where I can get something done for myself. And then in between, you really have to disassociate from everything else that's going on in your life and be super present.
Yeah.
And that's where you start to rethink the value of time, as you described it, you know, like really being able to say like, okay, for these hours, now this is the most important thing that I need to do. And it doesn't matter that I have a deadline tomorrow. And it doesn't matter that I have an 8 a.m. meeting tomorrow. This is where I need to be right now.
I love that. Yeah, I think that's incredible. All right. I think we're getting close to the end here. Again, I think you and I could probably sit and talk about these stories and related ideas for quite a while. But I've just got a couple of like little rapid fire design focused questions for you here. Some related to watches, some not. Can we just run through them? You can give me like, you know, couple word to 1 or 2 sentence answers, and we'll leave some folks with some stuff to go research and look up afterwards. Does that sound good?
Yeah, sure.
I can hear just like a tiny bit of trepidation in your voice here.
So there's trepidation just because if you're going to ask me about favorites, I'm very bad at favorites. I'm just going to preface this round with that.
That's all right. I'm going to ask you a couple favorites, but we'll try to stay away okay. from favorites.
All right.
We'll ask you some counter favorites as well. But
sure.
Let's start with going back to what we talked about at the beginning of the episode. What do you think is the biggest misconception that people have about the word design?
This is such a typical answer for somebody who works in design or is design adjacent. But the biggest misconception is definitely that design is just about the way something looks. That's part of it, of course. But like I said, you know, I'm always interested in the thinking behind how something came to be, how it got that final form.
Okay, great. Are there other people writing about design today, or who are some of the people writing about design today who you most enjoy reading?
Ooh, that's a really good question. Yeah, there are definitely people whose work I really appreciate. I'd have to call out my colleagues, Meg Miller and Jarrett Fuller, who are both design writers. They're great. Cliff Kwong, who I mentioned, is a really brilliant design thinker. He's transitioned from the editorial world into becoming a designer himself. So he has a ton of good insights. He wrote a book called User Friendly. Definitely check that out.
Yeah, Cliff's book is fantastic.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly what is interesting about writing about design. Like all of these things in our life that we interact with on a daily basis had to come from somewhere. Someone designed them, and he tells that story of how all of that came to be. So he's a great writer. I think that, you know, there are people who write about, one aspect of design that I'm really interested in is the marketing aspect of it. And so how design intersects with culture at large and makes us want the things that we want is a really interesting area. And people who write about that really well, Eliza Brooke is great. Kyle Chaika is really great. Katie Keller has a really beautiful writing style that is great for, she writes a lot about color. So all of those people are awesome. Check out any of their work.
Amazing. We'll drop some links in the show notes to some of those folks so that they're easier for people to find.
Right.
I want to reference one of your columns here, one that we didn't get a chance to talk about, but which is the story you did about David Carson, the graphic designer, and his sort of signature swatch. So he wears this kiwi colored swatch that's a kind of signature of his. For you, if you were going to have a signature watch, what would your signature watch be?
This is a really fun question. Prefacing this with the fact that I don't really love the idea of an object being definitive of me as a person, but I get the appeal of it. Yeah, I think I tend to lean classic, maybe a little bit androgynous. If I had to choose one watch, I think that I would love to own a vintage Omega Seamaster. I think that it is a beautiful old watch. I love a classic leather strap. I love a, you know, moderately sized watch face. And I think that there's just something about it that was beautiful when it was made, and it's beautiful today. And if I can find one within a price range that I can afford, I will buy one.
Amazing. We should talk afterwards. I can help you out there.
Thank you.
What's one design detail that you're just obsessive about? And it can be aesthetic, it can be functional, it can be something else. But whenever you're looking at a product or an object, what's the thing that just like you always have to take a deeper look at?
That is a really big question. But I do think that this is maybe more interior design than anything else. But one thing that I'm really obsessive about is lighting. I cannot deal with bad lighting in my home, in my office, or anywhere. I think that it can totally make or kill a mood. And so that is something, if I walk into a room and the lighting is off, even if it's not my house, I just want to go over and turn down the dimmer or turn up the dimmer, maybe, usually not. That is something that I am obsessive about.
Perfect. My wife makes fun of me all the time because I never use like the overhead lights in rooms. There's always, it has to be lamps that are like meant to light a room a certain way, like overhead can lights and stuff. They drive me crazy.
Me too. I actually learned from a cinematographer friend that every room should have 3 points of light in it. And that's how you get a really nice glowy look. So that way, it sort of just fills out the room if you have 3 points of light.
Perfect. There we go. I didn't realize I was going to get a free class in design today. That's awesome. Who's a designer who you would most like to see work on watches, whether it's create a watch, whether it's collaborate with a watch brand, something like that. But who's a designer who, as far as you know, is not working in watches, who you'd love to see work in watches?
That's a good question. And I think I have to say David Carson, just because he loves Swatch so much and he has never designed a watch. And I feel like he should do it. I think that we might be surprised with what he comes up with, simply because his favorite Swatch was the plain cream colored watch that he saw on, I think his name was Jean Robert.
Oh yeah.
And yeah, he said that was his favorite Swatch that he's ever owned. And I think that giving David the reins on designing a Swatch or any other brand would be really amazing.
Awesome. Well, all right. I'm going to ask you, I'll leave one favorite at the end here. I'm going to ask you one favorite, and that is, what is your favorite type of design object? You've got people who are obsessed with chairs. You've got people who are obsessed with lamps. Like, what is the thing, the design object that you just like as an object love?
So I'm going to go really big here. I love buildings.
Oh, perfect.
I love the scale of them. I love the process of designing and building them and their impact on space. I think that they're the most non-negotiable genre of design because you're forced to interact with them. Mm. If I had to choose one medium of design, I would say architecture and buildings is probably my favorite.
Love it. So we've gone from type on watch dials to architecture. That's a pretty good range here. I think we've covered a lot of ground.
Ultra big to ultra small.
Love it. Well, Liz, thank you so much for doing this. I really enjoyed this. Anybody who's listened to the show or read my writing will know these are topics I'm really fascinated by, and it's great to talk to somebody like you who's doing like really deep, smart thinking about them. And for people who haven't read your columns, again, we'll have them linked up so people can go check them out. I think everybody who's listening here should definitely do that. But yeah, we'll have to have you back on the show soon.
I would love that. Thanks so much.
Awesome. Thanks, Liz. Take care.
You too.